On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, September 13th, the Smashing Her Racket edition. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate, and joining me on today's episode is Anna Holmes, the editorial director at Topic.com. Welcome back to the show, Anna.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you back. And with Anna in Slate's New York studio is Slate editorial assistant Rachel Hampton. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
So we have a lot of good stuff to talk about on this week's episode. First, we're going to take a look at the case of Julia Salazar, a candidate for New York State Senate who has been hounded by accusations that she falsified her background and misrepresented her political views. Then we'll revisit the idea of Me Too comebacks from the perspective of the women whose careers were stunted after they were allegedly harassed by Harvey Weinstein and others. And finally, we'll talk about the tennis match that's been dominating the news this week. Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka, and the penalties heard around the world. So we'll talk about whether or not those penalties that arguably cost Serena the match were sexist. And then in our Slate Plus segment, we will decide whether something else is sexist. Man flu. If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can and should start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/thewavesplus. All right, let's get started. Julia Salazar, she is a 27-year-old Democratic socialist running to unseat an established Democrat in the New York State Senate representing Brooklyn. She has been getting a lot more mainstream press coverage than the average state politician, in part because her story has kind of taken a turn for the bizarre, in part due to some attacks from right-wing media. Rachel, why don't you give us a little primer on what's been happening?
Definitely. Giving a primer on this is extremely difficult because everything keeps coming out. So basically, the Senate race between Salazar and the Democrat incumbent has turned into a complete tabloid circus. Various investigations into Salazar's personal history have cast doubt on claims she's made about being an immigrant. She was born in Miami. They've cast doubt on her religious identity. She identifies as a Jew of color, but it was revealed that she grew up Republican and Christian, even appearing on Glenn Beck's show at some point as a college student. But several of her classmates have basically attested that her current political awakening is real. And then there's kind of a whole side story involving an affair with a New York Mets baseball player and thousands of dollars worth of Pottery Barn vouchers.
An alleged affair.
An alleged affair, yes. And just yesterday, she tweeted that she was about to be outed as a survivor of sexual assault. A new story today that one of the producers sent me said that she is actually a descendant of Catholic elites and that she has a trust fund, which casts even more doubt on her identifying as working class. And there's just a lot going on, and it's all distracting basically from the actual race at hand and from her platform, which includes affordable housing, abolishing ICE, universal health care, fixing the subway, and decriminalizing sex work. So we can get into it. I have many questions. Even just writing that up, I had so many questions.
Yeah, the thing that made this story interesting to me and slightly disturbing to me is just there's an element to the way that it's been covered and the fact that it's been covered so heavily that feels kind of gratuitously salacious in a way that strikes me as very sexist. So the New York Times headline on the piece about this alleged affair said, "An arrest? An affair? Keith Hernandez? Just another day in the Julia Salazar campaign." And that kind of makes it sound like she had an affair and an arrest and slept with Keith Hernandez, which everyone involved denies. And
well, she had, you know, she was arrested.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was never charged for that, but she was arrested. And then, but, you know, if you read the entire story, it becomes clear, or it comes to seem that this was a bogus claim that Keith Hernandez's ex-wife made, that Salazar had impersonated her on the phone to get access to her bank accounts. And I kind of think that Julia Salazar would not be getting this much press, and there wouldn't be so much interest in the personal life and kind of strange backstory of a New York State Senate candidate if she was an average looking man and not a relatively attractive 27-year-old woman.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't know that that really is the primary reason. I think that there's a lot of attention on young, upstart, attractive candidates for various local political races because of the involvement of young people in the political process, particularly in the DSA. And I think that, you know, there's a fair bit of attention on Julia Salazar because of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think that her ascendance and her visibility in the political press has brought visibility onto other people, you know, who are like her, whether they're like her politically or they're like her because they're also female and brunette and attractive. But so I don't think it's purely sexism. And I also believe that, you know, when the first reports came out about some inconsistencies in Salazar's story, that it was predictable that other news outlets would try and find other ones. And so I don't know that the continued focus on her, that I would deem it sexist. But I also am biased, and I have to confess to that, which is that I don't particularly feel sorry for her because everything adds up to her looking like someone who doesn't tell the truth about her biography. And I think that's very, very damning.
Yeah, I feel like the more I read about her, the more I became kind of surprised that she was even run as a candidate to begin with, which, you know, the things that she is saying was sort of a slip of the tongue or a misunderstanding. They don't seem like things that could actually be that somebody could actually mess up on their own biography, or that their, you know, the people surrounding them in their campaign could actually mess up so egregiously. Like, she literally said that, you know, I moved to the United States when I was a little baby, which is untrue. She was born in the United States. And, you know, she said that she was kind of living in between Colombia and the U.S. when she was a kid. And her mom was like, we went to Colombia a couple times. She also said she needed to work as a nanny to make ends meet in college. And Rachel, I did not know that she had a trust fund, which actually makes that claim even more insane. But she, you know, didn't need to make ends meet. She then later, when pressed on it, came out and said, well, no, I wasn't helping my family survive. And, you know, it was more like me having a job so I could go to the movies. That's not what anyone means when they say to make ends meet. And so I guess the question is, yeah, did she willfully misrepresent herself? Was this a genuine misunderstanding among members of her campaign? Did her views truly evolve over time? Or is she kind of like this cynical opportunist, or just young and capricious and taken in by the DSA, which is having a moment right now?
So I do, for reasons unknown, believe that her like political change is actually as she says it is. I do think that she has a tendency to misrepresent the truth, and that is not something you want in a candidate. And she admits in, I think, a Rolling Stone profile that she should have had a communications team or a press team when she started, and that she didn't have that, and that a lot of what she was saying was off the cuff. But it does seem strange to me that she wouldn't think that any of that would come back, that people wouldn't figure out that she was born in Miami, or that in the legal documents that she points to prove that she didn't have the affair, that she also said she had $600,000 in a trust fund, or that, you know, her own brother came out and said that they didn't grow up working class. Like, there are so many things that you just should have thought through. And
well, yeah, I mean, I would say, like, I agree with you, but I think she just lied. I mean, like, when I was 27, I didn't need a communications manager to know not to, like, make up stuff about my biography, whether or not I was running for office. Like, the age thing, I'm not buying the age thing. I'm not buying that, oh, she's a neophyte. Like, either you tell the truth about things or you don't. And I have very little patience right now in my life for people who are lie or are grifters because of the fact that, you know, we have one of those individuals in the presidency. Like, I just, you know, perhaps like 6 years ago, I would be more blasé about all this. But it speaks to a kind of nonchalance about things that are important in life, namely facts, and the idea that facts actually are fungible or don't actually matter. And this is not something that's specific to the DSA or to Julia Salazar. It's rampant on the among the GOP. But I think it does need to be called out wherever we see it.
I think this particularly bothers me because for somebody who's a member of the Democratic Socialists, who wants to abolish ICE, who, you know, supports a higher minimum wage and cares about affordable housing, this tells me that she has a complete misunderstanding about the actual meaning of being working class or an immigrant. And she thinks it's just, you know, something you can sort of fudge in a backstory and that it doesn't necessarily have much significance on how you conduct your day to day life. Like, that's the argument that somebody's making when they're saying, I worked hard as a nanny to make ends meet. They're saying, I understand what it's like to live as a working class person who has trouble making ends meet. She clearly doesn't. And so, you know, does she really understand what it would mean for a political candidate to have that experience? And it's especially sad because people were trying to smear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as lying about her background, which she wasn't. They were saying, you know, she says she, you know, her parents were working class, but look, she grew up in this nice looking house in Yorktown Heights, which, you know, yes, somebody can grow up in a house that doesn't look like a shack and still have working class parents. The fact that now Julia Salazar is trying to say the same thing and it's not true just validates these right wingers who believe that being a member of a marginalized demographic actually makes you more privileged and gets you unearned benefits through, you know, affirmative action, whether that's formal affirmative action policies or general efforts among progressives to put forth a more diverse slate of candidates. So it makes that whole very valid effort among progressives seem fake.
Yeah, so I think the general tenor of the lies to make her seem more marginalized and less privileged than she is also speaks to a general, I guess, weaponization of marginalization and of oppression that is not great for politics. I think there's like politics relatability going on here where she's trying to make her seem more relatable to her voters, and that really shouldn't necessarily be something that we're all focusing on, where it's like, can you do the job? Are you willing to basically learn? And there's this idea that you have to be working class or you have to be of a certain race to sympathize with what someone's going through, and that shouldn't be. We shouldn't have to share an identity for us to be able to work for somebody else's, I guess, betterment. And it's kind of gross that this is what people feel like we have to do to win campaigns. It's to say, I'm one of you versus I am advocating.
Yeah, it's patronizing. It's also like, you know, being working class or struggling financially or being an immigrant is not a costume you get to put on and then take off. And it's offensive to treat it like that. You know, this to me it gets to larger issues of like the ways in which, and I'm not going to say it's just young people, even because now I'm going to sound like an old grump, but a lot of young people and some older people like myself perform their identities or have been taught to perform their identities on social media as a way of creating some sort of like legitimacy, and this is the not the end result, but an end result when you have a political candidate, you know, who, as you said, Rachel, could get across a message that would resonate with potential voters based on what she wants to advocate for, not necessarily who she is or who she purports to be. But again, it feels of a piece of a certain sort of performance that people feel compelled to engage in this period of time in history, and I blame the internet.
But there is a legitimate case to be made, and I think some of us have made this case on this podcast in previous episodes, that there is a value to, you know, representation in a representative democracy, and that sharing an identity with your constituents can actually be meaningful and lead to meaningful governance. And, you know, that's an argument that's been made by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said it's unconscionable that a white man has been representing this district for so long that's majority people of color. We've seen it with Ayanna Pressley, who just won in Massachusetts. Same thing. She was running against a candidate who shared, she admitted he shared her views on almost everything. She said, we'll vote the same way, but I will lead differently because she's black and she is almost certainly going to be representing the only district in Massachusetts that is majority people of color. So I don't think it means nothing to have that identity if it informs the way that you represent your constituents. But yeah, I mean, she's definitely, Julia Salazar is certainly cheapening it by making it seem like just a convenient backstory that a politician might have in order to seem relatable to the people she's trying to convince. For me, the question now is this a referendum on the Democratic Socialists' ability to put forth legitimate candidates? I kind of feel bad for them. It seems like, you know, why didn't they see this coming? They're not experienced at running candidates who end up winning. People may be watching this and thinking, well, the way you run a campaign and the way you choose your candidates is the way you'll govern.
I mean, do I think it's a referendum on their ability to? No. I mean, maybe they should like vet candidates a little bit better. But I don't think it is damning of the DSA or disqualifying of the DSA. And I think that, you know, they are under more. Their candidates are under more scrutiny than they perhaps would have been or were 3 years ago, and it's perhaps growing pains. But like, I don't blame the DSA for the fact that Julia Salazar lies. I blame Julia Salazar for the fact that she lies.
Yeah, I also wonder how she was chosen and how much she. Like, if she was also lying to the people around her, you know, whatever committee was involved in deciding who they were going to run as a candidate in uh-huh. this district. I know I read a piece in the Daily Beast where the Greenpoint Williamsburg district leader for the Democratic Socialists, a guy named Nick Rizzo, who the Daily Beast said, you know, has taken credit for recruiting Salazar to run, said, I'm still convinced Julia is the best candidate we could run for this seat, but I really wish we'd known some more information. Mm-hmm. So maybe that information he wishes he had known was she's not an immigrant. She didn't, you know, help her family survive by working as a nanny in college. Like, she didn't actually graduate from Columbia University, even though she implied that on her campaign website. But the fact that he still thinks she's the best candidate for this seat, I mean, I guess that's kind of what you have to say when you're in the middle of a campaign. But yeah, I do wonder if there might have been somebody who would be a better choice. All right, let's leave it there.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Comebacks. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about comebacks, but mostly the comebacks of men, men who've admitted or been accused of doing horrible things. Louis C.K. reemerged at the Comedy Cellar to applause and the support from his fellow male comedians. We talked about that on this show. Matt Lauer is reportedly out and about telling fans that he'll be back on TV any day now. But we haven't talked enough, in my opinion, about the women who lost their careers for enduring and not perpetrating the sexual harassment and assault that has made it necessary for these men to stage their comebacks. This is actually a pattern that seems to be consistent across all of the cases that have come out during the Me Too movement. Louis C.K., Harvey Weinstein, Liz Moonves, and many of the women that they victimized say that they were blacklisted in their industries, found it difficult or impossible to find work because the men who allegedly or admittedly harassed them started spreading rumors that they were hard to work with or dull or bad at their jobs, or, you know, just refused to hire them for any of their productions because they wanted some sort of revenge against a woman who rebuffed them. So my question for you two is, do production companies, directors, producers in Hollywood bear any responsibility for helping these women recover their careers as part of a sort of internal effort to address and correct the harm that so many of them enabled?
That's really a tough question. I guess my first reaction would be, I don't know or have evidence, and it's not that like someone has to give me evidence that is, you know, would be upheld in a court of law, that let's say Mira Sorvino's career didn't continue to explode upwards because let's say Weinstein was speaking crap about her behind the scenes. I'm not doubting her version of events with regards to what he, like his harassment and abuse of her, but being an actress in Hollywood is an extremely insecure place to be for a variety of reasons, including the fact that, you know, one day you're hot, one day you're not. You know, mm-hmm. like if you make bad choices movie wise, then you can't open them anymore. Then it's less likely that a casting director or a director is going to cast you in as the lead in his or her next film. I mean, like it's by definition a very insecure occupation to have, and so. What I have yet to see is what I think of as proof that their careers were materially harmed because of back channeling and whispering. I'm not doubting that their careers were harmed because of the indignity and the humiliation of being abused in a variety of ways by a variety of men, whether physically or even emotionally. I'm it's hard for me to say that Hollywood needs to, or help people in Hollywood need to, provide what amount to maybe reparations to actresses who had no guarantee of having long stable careers anyway, because there's really no such thing as a long stable career for an actress unless you're like in the 0.05% of them, and that's probably even higher percentage than it is. Am I making sense? I'm not sure if I'm making sense, but
no, you make a lot of sense. And part of that insecurity of being an actress, in addition to all the things you mentioned, you know, part of which is like once you turn 30, no one wants you as a lead romantic role anymore. But it's you're an independent contractor too, and that also has legal implications for whether you can recover any damages for being sexually harassed or assaulted. Because harassment law covers employers and employees. And if you're just a free agent trying to get hired for a movie and you get harassed by Harvey Weinstein, you don't have any recourse against him. Mm-hmm. Rachel, what do you think?
I think it's very complicated. And I think all of this swirls around the idea of whether anyone is owed a career. And even the comebacks of like Louis C.K. and Matt Lauer, where who was it? Michael Ian Black or someone said you can't just put someone in jail or what, like exile for the rest of their lives. And it gets back to this idea that for some reason, Louis C.K. feels like he's owed a career and owed an audience and owed like this certain amount of prestige because I don't really know why. I've never found him funny. And so I think that it also, like, there are women who have been penalized in this way where their careers are, like, they're blacklisted for various reasons that don't include sexual assault, including Anne Hathaway, who was blacklisted or just went away for 5 years because people found her annoying. And so I think when you get to the idea of, as Anna said, like, reparations, it gets really complicated because it swirls into all this other sexism that's in the industry where your career could have tanked for other reasons. And so when you're specifically talking about like Mia Sorvino and other actresses who have been like sexually assaulted and harassed, who were blacklisted, I don't really know what the reparation process would look like for them other than people just continuing to not blacklist them, like hire them if you want to. But
Yeah, but we can't even prove that they were blacklisted. Meaning, there like, it might be that, like, you know, someone is actually not a good actress or, like, or wasn't right for that particular role, or the movie that he or she was cast in didn't do well, and therefore the you know, that person's career suffered. But like, you know, I also guess I react a little bit to, like, the idea that people are being blacklisted, because there were people who were being actually blacklisted in the mid-20th century for the political views. And in a way that I think I would just be careful with the word blacklist in this case.
No, it's okay. I think the closest thing that we have to proof is actually in the cases of Mira Sorvino and Ashley Judd, where Peter Jackson said that he was considering casting them in Lord of the Rings and actually asked them which roles they might want. And then he has come out after those women accused Harvey Weinstein of assault and harassment. He said, "Oh, yeah, actually, Miramax told me that they were a nightmare to work with." That's a direct quote. "And we should avoid them at all costs." This was in 1998. And he said, "You know, at the time, we had no reason to question them. In hindsight, I realized that this was probably the Miramax smear campaign in full swing." You know, who knows whether Ashley Judd and Mira Sorvino are a nightmare to work with. But I do think that I don't feel like I have reason to doubt that they were, you make a good point about the word blacklisted, that there was a concerted rumor campaign against them started by Harvey Weinstein. Because I think that stuff does happen in Hollywood, and that it is a lot, it's based on reputation. And, you know, somebody as powerful as him, who is the one making the decisions about who gets money for what project, probably has a lot of power over who gets hired. And I mean, everything that we know about Harvey Weinstein from the pieces that have come out about him over the past almost a year now. Wow, we're almost at the 1 year anniversary. Show him to be an incredibly vindictive person who will go to great lengths to get revenge against somebody who he believes has wronged him. You know, if you recall, there was a piece in The New Yorker about him hiring ex-Mossad agents to pose as reporters that were trying to get these women's stories so they would know exactly what they had against Harvey Weinstein. I mean, I would not put a limit on the things that he might do to try to prevent the story of his assault and harassment, alleged assault and harassment, from getting out. That said, I feel a little bit more convinced by the idea of some sort of reparations for these women than you two do, I think. You know, if I don't think I need to say this, but, you know, if they're good actresses and if they have good auditions for a part, like, I think that there should be a little bit of a concerted effort to reconsider some of these women for roles. I was very happy to see.
But you can't force that. I mean, like, you can't.
No,
force
you can't.
And therefore, like, the idea of reparations is something that is, you know, legally mandated or agreed upon, you know, by a broad swath of people who have power. And I just don't, I don't think you can expect that among the myriad of people who make the decisions about who gets cast in movies and television shows, which, you know, include directors, producers, writers, showrunners, you know, I mean, like, studio heads. I don't think reparations for actresses who were maligned by Harvey Weinstein or another powerful men are really an option. Like, I don't think you can enforce that. And I think that you also, if you start to enforce that you could go down, you know, a road that I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of actresses and actors who don't get cast because they're the wrong ethnicity or they're too old or what have you. And I don't think anyone is entitled to a career.
Yeah, I guess I have a hard time imagining what it would look like for an entire industry that is, you know, dispersed and very dependent on who's hot right now, which it's impossible to, you know, cast Mira Sorvino and Ashley Judd of 1998 now, because they've you know, been out of the spotlight for so long. So it would be a very different thing to cast them now than it would back then when they had just starred in a bunch of really big name films or TV shows. So, yeah, I have a hard time imagining how it would look. I did see one example in the second season of Glow. I don't know if you guys watched that, but Annabella Sciorra, who was nominated for an Emmy for her role on The Sopranos, and accused Harvey Weinstein of rape in October and said she didn't work for several years. I think in part because she says, you know, she was getting pushback of, we heard this about you. She kept encountering Harvey Weinstein. She would audition for a production and not realize he was involved. I think her situation could have been partially because there was a whisper campaign against her and partially because she didn't feel comfortable working in the industry for a while after that. And because Harvey Weinstein was everywhere and she was seeing her alleged rapist everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That felt meaningful to me as somebody who has been watching the inadequate punishment of all the men who have harassed and assaulted women, allegedly or admittedly, and not seen anything for the victims. And I think about things in terms of I think that's only half of the equation to think about punishment for the people who did wrong when, you know, I don't feel bad for actresses who probably are still doing just fine with the money that they've earned from the jobs they've already had. But I think it's worthwhile to think about how do you redress the harm that was done in addition to the person who did the harm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should consider, I mean, Peter Jackson came out and said that he listened to the Whisper campaign. Who are all the men, basically, who are listening to the Whisper campaign? And what are they doing now besides occasionally coming out in media? Like, why isn't Peter Jackson casting Mia Sorvino and Ashley Judd? He already said that he had in the, like, I feel like it's up to individual actors in this specific case, as Anna said, versus the entire industry, because I just don't trust Hollywood is going to do anything about it. And so I'm really curious about the people who chose to listen to the Whisper campaign and chose to believe that these actresses were difficult to work with. And would they have believed that if it wasn't about women? Would they have believed that if it was Orlando Bloom, who someone said was difficult, would he still have been in Lord of the Rings? Probably.
I mean, people still cast Mel Gibson to star in movies.
Exactly.
And he does not seem like somebody who's particularly easy to work with.
I don't think it's as like cut and dry as that. Like, do I personally think Mel Gibson should be cast in anything? No, but he, like, people make decisions to cast him because they think he's going to make the money. Like, what it comes down to is money and power. And like, the Peter Jackson is under no obligation to cast Mira Sorvino or Ashley Judd just because they were subject to a Whisper campaign, you know, over a decade ago. He should cast the person that's right for the role that he has to cast for, and they may not fit that. They may not fit be the right person, and so he's under no obligation to cast them or to make their careers whole as part of reparations, even if he was subject and listened to a Whisper campaign. I mean, he came out to talk about it. I'm not saying that's all he needs to do, but I think this is all the larger issue here is about women in Hollywood and women's careers in Hollywood being subject to the whims of men who control all the money pretty much in Hollywood. It's about the sort of roles that they're given, which tend to be smaller and much more subservient to the male roles. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is a symptom of a larger thing that has to do with women in Hollywood, and not just women who are in front of the camera, but like the lack of directors, producers, et cetera, who are female, who are in positions of power to make those decisions. And I think that what's happening, in part because of Me Too, but it precedes Me Too, it precedes, you know, what erupted last year, is a reckoning about like inclusion and representation in Hollywood that actually started years and years and years ago, in part because of agitations of people on the internet pointing out the inequities and the ways in which the stories that we're seeing on small screens and big screens are not actually reflective of the world that we live in. I don't think Me Too would have erupted without that without those discussions preceding it. And I guess what I'm saying is that I think the larger issue is the opportunities women are given across the board in Hollywood and elsewhere, not whether Mira Sorvino or Ashley Judd's careers were harmed because Harvey Weinstein, you know, enacted a smear campaign against them.
What you're saying makes me think of something that just happened in D.C. at a baseball stadium. So we are one of our local celebrity chefs, Mike Isabella, has been accused of harassment and mistreatment by several women. And people have been boycotting his restaurants. And he, the Nationals baseball stadium, I think removed like a little stall he had there and decided to fill it with a rotating slate of women chefs. And that seemed like an interesting response to harassment. Like, you know, hopefully they're also considering the harassment policies and accountability measures that they're that are in place at the stadium. But I'm like, it kind of felt stupid to me that they were taking this instance of harassment and saying like, well, let's just give women in general the opportunity to cook some things, you know, because this man cooked some things and he harassed people. So like maybe women will do better. At the same time, I was thinking, you know, as you're talking about, Anna, it is the fact that he is able to become a celebrity chef while allegedly treating people so horribly behind the scenes and possibly scaring women out of the industry is part of a system where women aren't given opportunities. I'm wondering if something like that, you know, in Hollywood now, like there's been a renewed effort to get women into positions of power and, you know, part of the Time's Up movement, they're talking about how to get more women behind the camera. It's important, but it still, to me, seems to be missing the point a little bit.
I mean, I think it just gets to the fact that there's really nothing that's going to repair what's happened. Like, I just think that all of these efforts that we're trying to do is trying to paper over the harm that's been done, and it's that's never going to happen. And I think that we are all kind of just spinning our wheels because we don't know really how to keep it from happening. I'm sure it's still happening right now, and we don't really have measures in place. And men still run most of the world. And so I think that we're really just
white
men specifically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I really think we're just trying to paper over the fact that people have been harmed. They're still being harmed. And people, and the men who are doing the harms are allowed to have comebacks. And I think that every single measure that we're trying to institute is just going to have that kind of sadness. It's going to be tinged with that kind of sadness.
That's a great point, Rachel. That's a great note to end on. I'm really curious to hear what our listeners think about whether and how Hollywood bears any responsibility for helping the careers of the women who were maligned by Harvey Weinstein, et cetera. Janet Jackson is another one. Liz Moonves apparently tried to torpedo her career after her breast was exposed at the Super Bowl. I mean, this stuff goes really deep, so let us know if you have any better ideas than we do about how to redress that harm. Serena Williams. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Okay. So Serena Williams. So during the women's final of the U.S. Open on Saturday, Serena was penalized numerous times, first because of an allegation that her coach was making hand gestures, i.e. coaching, from the grandstand, then because she slammed her racket down in frustration after losing a point and the racket broke, and then because she spoke very sharply to the umpire in response to him giving her the first two infractions, or in response to his response to her first two infractions. She then ended up losing the match to Naomi Osaka. So did Serena violate some sort of rule or rules? I believe that she did, like according to what the rule books say. Did she deserve the penalty she received? I would say no. And a lot of other people also say the same thing. As Sally Jenkins put it in the Washington Post on Sunday, after Serena's loss to Osaka and the resulting furor around what had happened, Sally said that the umpire wasn't going to take it from a woman pointing a finger at him and speaking in a tone of aggression. And we will never know whether young Osaka really won the 2018 U.S. Open or had it handed to her by a man who was going to make Serena Williams feel his power. It was an offense far worse than any that Williams committed. I'm going to quote from someone else who had some smart things to say about this. It's Rebecca Traister, who in New York Magazine's The Cut wrote on Sunday that there was also a racialized aspect to the umpire's reaction to and then penalization of Serena. Rebecca wrote that Serena was livid, and one thing that black women are never allowed to be without consequence is livid. Women's challenge to male authority, and especially black women's challenge to authority, is automatically understood as a threat, a form of defiance that must be quashed. So I guess I would back up and say, I'm looking at Rachel now. Rachel, did Serena deserve the penalties that she received for the infractions that she committed?
I do not think that she did. I will admit that I only watched tennis with my grandfather, so I don't really know a lot about the rules. But the thing, Rebecca Traister started her piece with something that really resonated with me, which is she started off with saying, I don't care about the rules because the rules were created in a time when tennis was primarily wealthy white people, which it still is. Those rules were designed to have decorum back when, like, visible sweat was considered sinful. And so I really I really don't care that if Serena did break these rules, it's because these rules were never designed. They were designed to keep someone like Serena off the court. And so I really don't care if she broke the coaching rule. So many people have broken. And then so many men, as she consistently states, break this visible anger rule where she like smashed her racket. And I if she broke the rules, she only got penalized because she was a black woman breaking the rules, because those rules are consistently broken by men all the time. So I agree with Rebecca that I don't care if she broke the rules. Like, she got unfairly penalized for something that everyone in the game basically does.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Christina?
I have maybe a little bit of an unpopular opinion on this.
Go for it.
I think that Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, made some good points, at least helped me understand it, because like you, Rachel, I don't really know anything about the rules of tennis. Or I learned that the guy, Ramos, who I thought might be called a referee, is actually called an umpire.
Yeah.
Which was strange. So yeah, the umpire apparently is known for being a stickler for the rules. And, you know, during the same tournament, he made the same or a similar call against a man. In cases where he can use his discretion, he will often follow the letter of the law or err on the side of punishing the players or penalizing the players instead of letting them, you know, get away with something or giving them a verbal warning instead of actually enacting a penalty. So I am hesitant to say that he wanted what the quote that you gave from Sally Jenkins, Anna, I thought was a little bit hyperbolic. I don't think that Ramos was trying to show Serena his male power by giving her a penalty. I also think that it's possible to understand that somebody has a reason for behaving a certain way. I mean, Serena has been accused of cheating and doping because she's so muscular. And those accusations have been lobbied against her for the entirety of her career. And so I can see why being accused of cheating by having her coach her from the sidelines would be especially offensive to her. And that is one thing that she was really screaming at him about, just saying, like, you know, I'm not a cheater. At first, she was very calm. And then later, when she realized he actually gave her the penalty, she got more angry, where she was like, I'm not a cheater. Why are you accusing me of being a cheater? I think it's possible to understand the reasons that she behaved that way and to think that she shouldn't have behaved that way. And for me, the element that really stood out as I watched the video was, you know, she is arguably the greatest and most famous athlete that exists right now. She's incredibly wealthy, incredibly well known. And I think that she has a responsibility, especially when she's playing somebody who's a lot younger than her. And this, you know, this was Osaka's first U.S. Open. She did a report on Serena Williams in third grade.
Yeah,
you know, not that this should necessarily determine how Serena plays the game, but I think that she has a responsibility to to play by the rules. And smashing a racket, I agree with you, Rachel, that there probably shouldn't be a rule against that. But
why not? Why not, though? Why not?
Because I don't think it matters. I don't think it. I think that if you are not hurting somebody or cheating and you just show anger by mm-hmm. smashing your own racket mm-hmm. that you are going to have to pay for, or your whatever company is going to have to pay for, that it shouldn't matter. And that I think there are a lot of rules in tennis, including the fact that they didn't let her wear a bodysuit, which she specifically chose because she gets pulmonary embolisms.
Yeah, that wasn't a rule about tennis. That was someone that was the French Open. I feel like there are rules that each competition or the officials of each competition may have. And then there's the governing body of Grand Slam tennis events, and then there's how certain umpires behave, and so like who makes rules, I think, depends on the circumstance. I mean, on the one hand, I agree with you. She should be able to smash her racket and then nothing happens. But like the fact is, there's a rule against smashing your racket, and maybe the rule should go away. But if she breaks a rule about smashing her racket, then it's hard to say, well, she shouldn't have been punished for that. that said, you know, and actually I don't have the data, and I'd be interested in it, as to whether or not other people who smash their rackets don't get penalized, and she did. What I do think felt very gendered and racialized was the speed with which the umpire, you know, penalized her. On the one hand, I understand that, like, she is subject to penalization because she was actually breaking rules. On the other hand, I think that other people get away with breaking those rules in ways that she didn't. But it's just that I'm very, very, very torn about it. I'm very torn about it. I do think that she was and is under a lot of pressure. Not just because she was in the final of a Grand Slam event, but because she was trying to go for her 24th win, which would have tied her with Margaret Court. She has had a number of health issues. She had a baby and was coming back from that experience. And you know that I'm not someone who's had a baby, but I understand that it takes a physical toll on your body.
She particularly, you know, had a life threatening complication after her C-section, mm-hmm. and in her recent HBO documentary series, she talked a lot about being scared that she wouldn't be able to live up to her history and reputation after coming back from that. And so I saw that come out too in the videos.
Yeah, but and you know, I think that she comported herself very, very, very well after the match was over, and you know, that was a really, really tough moment because she had to deal with her own anger and process her own anger and disappointment, but also, you know, put herself in the shoes of Osaka, who that was a really intense and upsetting moment, as well as a very positive one for Osaka. And I think that Serena, you know, was extremely mature and gracious about it. But I don't necessarily think that it's nothing when you smash a racket if that is against the rules. And maybe the rule needs to be changed, but the rule's not changed.
I think the smashing the racket was definitely a penalty. I think what made it worse and what made the subsequent call worse is that the first infraction that she had, the coaching, was something that they couldn't prove that she saw the coaching.
Right.
They couldn't necessarily prove that the hand signal that he gave was coaching in
right.
the moment, although he admitted it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think,
and also, yeah, she didn't turn to him. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that if she just got penalized for smashing the racket, it would have been like, okay, fine, yes. But that would have been the first one, and she wouldn't have lost a point, and mm-hmm. then she wouldn't have lost a game after mm-hmm. that for calling him a thief.
Right.
And so I think that it was the building of infractions predicated on one that just seemed harshly levied at Serena specifically,
mm-hmm.
where like off-court coaching is apparently something that happens all the time,
right.
and seems very hard to prove. And so I think that is part of the reason why this felt so fraught, is that the first call just set up the entire game, and the
right.
first call just felt very capricious.
Yeah, it was like a snowball effect. I mean, yeah, it's like you can't you can't look at those infractions in isolation because one built up to another, or at least the umpire's reaction to each escalated, and therefore her reaction to his reaction escalated.
Yeah, exactly. And I think her reaction, the first one, she's like, I wouldn't cheat to win. And why would she? She has 23 grand slams. Why would she cheat after?
Yeah,
and so I think that the idea that she, one of the most decorated players in the sport, is cheating, I can understand why she got so angry at the first one. And then for everything to just build, I can understand why her anger got, like, why it got so out of hand and she smashed the racket and she kind of went off.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I definitely don't, you know, think she was cheating or anything. I mean, her coach did say afterwards that, yes, I was doing it, but all the coaches do it, which, you know, I think is broadly true, which, you know, I think that was his fault.
Yeah,
and not
his fault.
But, you know, I think she had lost to Osaka before. And at the time that he started coaching her from the sidelines, Osaka was playing better and I think won the first set. The call that seemed most egregious to me was the final one for verbal abuse that cost her the game.
Right.
And because it was the third one, not because of that specific call, but because it was the third. And that decision by Ramos to say that was verbal abuse when she didn't curse at him and he didn't warn her ahead of time, like, hey, if you keep going like this, I'm going to, you know, give you the game penalty. That seemed completely subjective to me. On the Hang Up and Listen podcast, they were saying that there is, you know, something in the rule books that says if you impugn an ump's character and accuse him of, I don't know, making a bad, accuse him of having bad morals or poor ethics or something, then that it can be a reason to call verbal abuse. But, you know, I think that is something where if you look at the way men treat umps and women treat umps and who gets called for what, I think there is a good argument for racism and sexism there. And certainly the way that it was portrayed in the media, in a lot of media outlets afterwards, was incredibly racist and sexist. There was a tweet going around that put two New York Post headlines side by side.
Oh, God.
The first one, yeah, I bet you can already guess where this is going. The first one was some baseball player or coach, quote unquote, arguing a strike by sticking his finger in an umpire's face, like right up in his face, looked like he was going to poke his eye out. Mm-hmm. The second one was Serena pointing at the umpire from down on the court, and she was having the mother of all meltdowns. So I think definitely the way people were interpreting her afterwards.
It's totally gendered and racialized. No, I totally agree with that. She, like, that there was a cartoon that an Australian cartoonist, Mark Knight, I have his name down here, did for the Herald Sun, which is like the Post, owned by News Corp, the Murdochs. And the cartoon depicts her after having slammed her racket on the ground. She's like jumping in midair. She's having a tantrum. So she's in midair. She's having a midair tantrum, wailing like a child. And there's like a pacifier on the ground, like a literal baby pacifier on the ground, as if it has just dropped out of her mouth. And now she's screaming and having a tantrum. But so it's not just that. But then, like, the way that she's drawn is drawn in a very caricatured way that is, quite frankly, really reads as racist. And like something that you would have seen in the early 20th century in the United States, or maybe even the mid to late 20th century in the United States, and sometimes on the pages of the New York Post. But you know, and then in the background of the cartoon is a depiction of Naomi Osaka, who is given lighter skin and blonde straight hair and like a tiny little body. So the juxtaposition between Naomi and Serena in that cartoon is in itself telling, not to mention just the way that Serena's depicted. But, you know, my reaction to that is, having been married to an Australian at one point, and I'm not saying this about him, but about his friends.
they
can be very casually racist or explicitly racist. They like, you know, it's not a paradise over there.
Yeah, seeing that cartoon just repeated over and over on my timeline on Monday was like, it was just the way that you apparently can't conceptualize a Naomi as also Black.
Yeah.
Along with Serena just says so much. And also just the way that she's portrayed just really hammers home just the way that Naomi Osaka has kind of been forgotten in this entire debacle, where obviously a lot of this is like a lot of this is around Serena, but Naomi's first Grand Slam win is going to be forever kind of tainted by this moment. And she was crying as she stood up to accept the trophy. People were booing her. Not really booing her, but
they weren't booing her.
But I could, standing up there as a 20-year-old, like, while everyone is booing you at what is supposed to be the greatest moment of your life, playing against one of your biggest heroes who you know is angry, is just, I can't imagine being her. And then seeing this cartoon, there's no way she didn't see it, because she's faced so much of the same like racism that Serena has. And to see yourself portrayed as basically a white woman, like, she looks white in that cartoon. It was terrible.
Yeah, she. Yeah. There's something that's very there's something about her depiction. It's not only that she is depicted as white, which is you know, Naomi Osaka is not just Japanese, but she's half Haitian.
Mm-hmm.
She's not white.
Yeah,
she's not even close to white.
Yeah, she's not white at all. And also, this also gives this idea that mixed people are all have to be mixed with white. And I feel like that's something that it's.
But she's also portrayed as like being very innocent and kind of almost like fragile, like none of her physical power and agency comes across in that cartoon at all. She seems like she's like rail thin and kind of like, like she's.
And her breasts are weirdly centralized.
Yeah.
And I know that this is all supposed to be like, oh, well, it's a cartoon. It's, you know, exaggerating. But the purposes of cartoons is every exaggeration means something.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the ref white, too. I'm sorry, the ump.
The ump. Yeah, there's just something like she her actual physical dominance and agency is removed completely in that cartoon, so as to contrast her with big bad Serena. It's a really gross cartoon, but I can't say that I'm surprised that it came from the place it came from.
I can't say I'm surprised, but I forever have the ability to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we have a lot of listeners in Australia, so I wonder if any of them will email us and tell us their reaction and their community's reactions to the cartoon. You can email us at thewaves@slate.com. Ugh, poor Osaka.
Poor Osaka. But also, congratulations, Osaka. This is a great
moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I'm excited to see her career continue.
She's amazing.
Yeah. She's a really exciting young player.
Yeah. All right. Should we get on to our recommendations?
Sure. My recommendation this week is not something that is new. It is, in fact, something that is a few years old, but it is a Nancy Meyers movie called It's Complicated that I have watched a wild amount of times in the past 2 weeks because it's now on HBO.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it's starring Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin, and it's just it's one of those movies where it's not me. I can't see myself in it because I'm a Black woman and there's no Black people in this movie.
There are there?
Yeah, no, it's not. But it's very much just heartwarming fluff, and it just nourishes my spirit in these like weird autumn times where it's not summer and it's not autumn and it's gross outside and you can feel the beginnings of like seasonal depression coming on.
Yeah. Also, it has like a great kitchen.
It
right?
does. Oh my God.
See,
it is. Yes.
That's something that's colorblind. Everyone wants a great kitchen.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
Isn't that the Nancy Meyers thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Like
the kitchen.
Big, beautiful kitchen.
The bakery. I just. It made me want to move to Santa Barbara and open a bakery.
Yeah. There's no Black people there. Yeah. I just warn you, there's no Black people in Santa Barbara. I'm always like, I want to move to this place. I want to move to that place. And I'm like, it's really very homogenous.
Yeah.
Like, I think Maine is beautiful, but I'm like, but there's no other Black people there.
Yeah. Yeah.
As someone who grew up in New Hampshire, I can confirm that perspective.
Yeah. what's funny about the kitchens and like Nancy Meyers movies or another, you know, pop culture products where the people are obviously well off, is that I always think, if I had that kitchen, I would cook. I don't think actually that I would. Because if I had that kitchen, I would be wealthy enough that I get someone else to cook for me.
Exactly.
But I always have this fantasy that, like, that's the thing that's going to get me cooking. And when, in fact, I live in New York, I have a tiny apartment, with a tiny kitchen, and it's much easier just to order out. I might rewatch the movie now that you've mentioned it because I haven't seen it since it came out.
It's really good.
Okay, my recommendation is a film called Crime and Punishment that came out theatrically about 2 weeks ago, and at the same time was being distributed and is being distributed on Hulu. So those of you who don't live near a theater where it's playing, you can get it on Hulu. It is a documentary, a full-length feature documentary by the director Stephen Meng. It is about a group of 12 New York City Police Department officers who go to court to take the police department and the city of New York to court over what they allege, I think rightly, are mandated quotas of arrests. So they're being forced to that basically as part of their jobs as police officers, there are quotas that they are being given in terms of numbers of arrests that then lead to the arrests of mainly people of color who are in struggling economic circumstances, and the police officers are rightly disturbed by this and believe that the policies of the department are racist. Now, this was a number of years ago that this was being filmed, but it is a very big deal, as a lot of us know, for a police officer to go up against his or her fellow officers or the institution of a police department like the NYPD in general. And as we see through the course of the film, they are penalized for speaking out. Their careers are held back for their speaking out against what they believe, again, rightly, are racist, classist policies. It's just a very, 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 very powerful documentary. The access that the director got, not just to the officers who are speaking up, but to other experts and people within the police department, is really extraordinary. And it's especially powerful, I think, for me, because we are living in a time in which it feels as if all of these horrific things are happening and no one's doing anything about it. I'm namely talking about the presidential administration, or that people feel unable to do something about it. And again, this film was filmed many years ago, and actually covers a lot of time. But it feels important not just because of what the officers are protesting against, but because it's an example of people putting themselves and their careers on the line for to speak up about what is right and what is wrong. So I cannot recommend it enough. It's very, very, very powerful. Crime and Punishment. It's on Hulu. I think it's still in theaters. I should also caveat that it was produced in part by someone who works for the same company that I work for. But that's not why I'm bringing it up. I actually think it's really fantastic and it's gotten really great reviews. And yeah, it's not, there's nothing really gendered about it, except there is one female police officer in the group of 12. And how she is penalized is different and quite interesting than that of her male colleagues. But I would say if you care about communities and you care about policing and you care about injustice and people who are trying to overcome injustice, you're going to like this documentary.
Those sound like two very good antidotes to the malaise that I've been feeling the past couple of weeks between the news and the constant rain.
Yeah.
I am recommending an album. It's the soundtrack to Sorry to Bother You, which is a film we talked about on this show. So I'm going to Oakland this weekend, and I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know what I watched recently that was set in Oakland, Sorry to Bother You, and it had such great music, and I'd like to listen to that music. And lo and behold, the soundtrack was incredibly good. It's a bunch of new music from The Coup, that's C-O-U-P, a band fronted by Boots Riley, who wrote and directed the film. They got big in the 90s. And every song on this album is a total banger. A lot of them are really joyful and dancey and made me want to go to the club. There's also a lot of really good weird stuff in there, which is, you know, the band is very weird, but also accessible because the beats are amazing and they've got really tight musicianship. It's pretty much my exact ideal mix of hip hop and punk and funk and synths. And what's great about it is it's also there's a total murderer's row of guest artists, including some Oakland artists like Toon Yards, who I love and who did the score to the movie, and E40, who's a legendary Bay Area rapper. Plus, there's Janelle Monae and Killer Mike. And I loved it. And I think no matter what kind of music you like, you will probably find something to like on that soundtrack. And I didn't realize that the film was actually based on a concept album by The Coup from 2012. So I learned a thing while Wikipediaing it.
Cool.
That's our show for today. Thank you to our production assistant, Alex Barish, and our producer, Danielle Hewitt. This is her very first episode that she's producing.
Yay.
We're so happy that she's our new producer. If you like The Waves, please subscribe on your podcast app of choice and give us a rating and review. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Anna Holmes and Rachel Hampton, I'm Christina Cotterucci.